quality is actually, I mean, it sounds really good, like on the phone. You can't hear as well here, but like at home, like it's.
Oh, really? It sounds really well. All of them? Because I thought the battery was going out on this, and then this. Okay. Anyway, Dave, is David here? I got your room. Dawn. So just, you know, give it another turn of the crank. So what do you have for me? Do you have projects? Just want to hand in? If anybody has a paper, I'll take that too. Can you email these? Papers can be emailed up to Wednesday. Okay. That's about it. I gotta have time to read them. I'll still, if you have questions on your paper, I'll still answer them via email if you want. This is paper. Project.
Top tier paper.
So how many people owe me a project?
Projects and then paper.
They're coming?
Yeah.
All right, you know the drill. Bring them in by the final exam, all right? Okay. Yeah.
Put it all together and send it to you at once.
I want that,
like as a comment?
I want them to email you and tell you what they thought.
Okay.
And what they did. If they did something on YouTube, they can just say it. Just a page for each person, an email from each person.
Okay?
That you did. That, are we still clear on that? Yeah.
What if, like, you had them over at your place and you forced them to watch it both?
Yeah, I saw you. Just gave me the list of names on the talk to me afterwards. All right. Yeah. Well, we'll stop at 5. That was the deal. Okay. We negotiated that. I wanted 20, and you guys gave me 5. Right, I'll put these together. All right. Well, let me finish Milton, and then let's wrap this thing up. Any other? I'll do what I can. I'll take questions for the final, but I was thinking, I don't know if I can really just review stuff, but what I'll do is what I've done on the previous two exams. After I write the exam, I'll think about it, and I'll send you an email with your study tips, all right? Will that work? Okay. That reminds you that what to look at. Don't forget it. The syllabus is up online. That's the latest version with the page numbers, okay? I'm actually pretty impressed with some of you guys are really reading a lot more than the assignments. I wasn't quite ready for that, but I really am impressed when you go off and read one of the longer works or something else. One other thing I never got to, I handed out since it's a 200 level class, I thought, you know, some of you just never even seen an English paper before and don't know what I'm talking about when I talk about a topic sentence, so I just Xeroxed something from a literature book that included a sample student paper. Now, this is not a comparison, but they do underline the thesis sentence and the topic sentences, and it gives you some idea of the way an English paper might look. I mean, it's not even a really good model, but generally the idea, you know, I look for a thesis statement, I look for paragraph topic sentences, right? You know, some general statement before you start summarizing or going into details. You have to be able to generalize. It's the big trick. If you can learn that at 4 years in Purdue, if you can learn that by the end of 5 years of graduate school, you're doing well. But you can't start too early on just trying to say that this is what writing is about. And I mean, I know how difficult it is. I sat down. I think a professor should write the assignments he gives. And I sat down last night to write a little paper on, and I'll read it to you. It's really dreadful, but it gives me humility. So when I go to grade yours, I realize what you guys have been going through. And I've been doing this for a while, but it never sinks in. It's always just as hard. I come, you know, you start thinking stuff and wandering all over the place, and you have to come back and try and put it in some kind of order. And I think my mind wanders a lot more than yours does. Like, that's the only thing I can say. So I have more trouble than most people. So let's do Milton, all right? Let's finish him up. So Milton has got this orchestra. He's got all of Don Quixote's trumpets in his head. This guy's got a supreme imagination. He's a little dried-up Puritan smoking a pipe. Goes blind by the age of 50. Unhappily married. Goes out, gets married, brings the wife home. She lasts about 6 weeks and runs home to her daddy, her mommy. Can't stand that guy. Takes him a year to get her back. All right. So as a person, he's difficult, but incredibly smart, and he's got this imagination, and it, you know, he's sort of the perfect English major, right? A little weird, but beautiful inside. Okay. And, so let's take. And he really produced the great. Everybody made fun of him at college. And he showed them, all right. He really produced the great work. Where's my notes? So, in the terms of this, the theme of individualism that I've been tracing, he really combines the theme of individualism with this submission to something bigger. In other words, whatever he means by God, all right? And what he means by God is, we won't even get into that, but you know, something bigger. As a Puritan, as a Protestant, and he's nothing if not a Protestant, the two ideas almost go together. Because he is living in after the Protestant Revolution, and what happened, as I said before, the corporateness, the idea that the church intervened for you with God, the church explains God to you, that's the kind of Catholic position. And the old Mass, when you went into the Mass before 1215, you sat there and a priest talked to the back wall, and all you saw was his back, because he was interceding between you and the mysteries of religion. Okay. That's still the way it's done in the Greek Orthodox Church today. Now, they reversed it in the Western Catholic Churches around 1215. But you still, there's a corporate sense. Well, Luther came along and he really put the individual into religion. It became the individual's understanding of religion that mattered. And this developed over the course of 100 years until we get to Milton in 17th century England. And it all culminated in a Puritan revolution in 1640, there was a 20-year period after they, where they deposed the Parliament, deposed the King of England, Charles I, and then they actually chopped his head off in 1648. And Cromwell, the military leader, took over, and the people he were leading, the Puritans, really their main objection was to the corporate structure of the English Church, which had, under Queen Elizabeth, essentially been the Catholic Church in English name. This is why today you have things, you hear the phrase, a high Anglican, or an Episcopal, the American version is an Episcopalian. So it's very high church, lots of capes and hats, and you know, ceremonies and paraphernalia and stuff like that. Well, this was not Milton's world. He didn't believe in that at all. Okay, he thought that you did not know God through the church. You knew it through individual study and meditation and reading. Education is everything. Right? You're still living in the wake of it. Matter of fact, this course may be the last wave on the shore. Okay, now as we go to video games. But the reason we can even think of assigning this much reading for you is because there's this expectation that how can you possibly know anything about what's important unless you read widely in this literature. And for a Milton, this was absolutely essential, and he devoted his life to it. Because God came to you as an inner light, not something you were told. You had to wait for it to sort of... It was called the inner light theory of religion that the Puritans had, that every person had to feel these things individually. Okay. Well, this naturally led to, fragmentation because, like, everybody's got a different idea of what's important. And that explains, really, the fragmentation of churches that we live with in America today. It all came out of, really, England and Germany, where, so you know, suddenly the Methodists decided one thing and then whatever, you know, the Lutherans were doing something else, okay? And those were the people who immigrated early in America and set up these churches. So you see that fragmentation, but it really is because this sense that an individual or a group of individuals could determine their own destiny is what's going on. Well, that's the background to Milton.
So if we look at Dante as, like, you know, like medieval religious base, and then like Boccaccio's like individualism, you know, like, would it be fair to say this is kind of a balance between the two?
It would be fair to say I've been talking nonsense too, because you could say, hey, look at Dante. I mean, how individual can you get? Right? And in fact, so that would be a counter argument to it. And look at Chaucer, full of individuals, but then again, he's got that corporateness, the beginning of the Canterbury Tales, where we're all on this big pilgrimage. And, right, so you know, you can argue right against this theory too, and people do all the time. But I, you know, again, I set up the simple pattern because I think it would. But you're absolutely right. Dante will handle it both ways. All right, but I think actually you'd have to give the balance even in a Dante to the corporateness. He really believed in the universal church. He believed everything was universal, church, state, all together. Big Islamic Republic, frankly. Okay, combining church and state. Right? The emperor and the pope should not be at war. They should all be one universal harmony. Okay, the experience of England led us to believe that these things really had to be separated. Okay, and that's, you know, really the great experiment, and that has been America, okay, in our Constitution, where we really radically separated church and state, because you just can't have the one branch interfering with the other. Okay, this is a process that seems to be completely misunderstood by the current administration, but it, you know, they're on the way out. All right, you can be a very, very religious country, but it's not something that we should be passing laws about, and that's what's going on. Anyway, Milton's position would be God is external. He may be out there. You can't know very much. But our knowledge of him is internal. I think Dante would have thought you know, if you turn the right corner, you'd see God. In fact, that's what happens in the Paradiso. And once you get up past the stars, he's just out there waiting for you. Okay? You don't see him directly. What you see in Dante is 4 million angels singing in a chorus, okay, and it all develops in this giant Star Wars sort of visual display up there, all right? But the thing is waiting out there. On the other hand, in Milton, if Milton glorifies the individual is not enough, and that's the lesson of Satan in this book. Satan, he falls mainly because he just has this complete refusal to believe that there's something more than him in the universe. Right? He just can't believe that he's not the center of everybody's attention. Okay, and for Milton, he's a metaphor for that kind of belief. Insofar as for Milton, as far as you think that you're the center thing and the most important thing, and that you're king of the hill, you are mimicking Satan and the fall of the angels, because there's something out there bigger than you, whether it's a sense of goodness or rightness or a kind of Looney Tune God. If you read Book 3 of Paradise Lost, I mean, Milton's presentation of God is very weird. He sits up there talking to Christ. He laughs a lot. Everybody hates Milton's representation of God, but it's almost like he's doing it on purpose. He puts together what few fragments there are in the Bible, and they're very few, that tell you what God might look like. I mean, we know he sits on a sea of jasper. That's about it. So in Milton, when you get to heaven, there's that sea of jasper. But otherwise, you just sort of hear a voice, and you know, he's certainly not wearing a beard or anything like that. Okay. Anyway, Satan is traditionally people like the presentation of him because he's so compelling. Okay. That guy is, he's like the 300. He is deadly honest. He's down and out, but by God, he's going to fight back. God hurls him down into the flaming, fiery lake, and he's lying there prone, and the first thing he says, I'm going to get my revenge, you know, and we go, yay, Satan, right? And there's this whole school of Satan, you know, because he's so heroic, okay? And he starts, and he gets his guys together, and they start, they realize they can't fight a war, right? Because they've been beaten in the 6-day battle, which is talked about in book 6, but they can lie and cheat, right? You can't win by force, you can win by deception. And they decide, and they get it, and Satan gets this plan. He says, well, you know, I can't like attack God directly. But what I can do, well, he's got these two people he's created, because we heard rumors of it. I think I'll get them. And I'll sort of ruin his little aquarium he's set up on Earth. Okay, with his little two pet turtles or whatever that he's got there. And that's what happens. At the end of book 2, he flies out of hell. Satan goes on this mission to land on Earth. And he comes down in the middle of the Garden of Eden in book 4. In book 3, God's just sitting up there watching all this happening and laughing, you know, about how useless it all is. Well, Satan lands in the middle of book 4, and he hears Adam and Eve talking. And of course, like almost in a bad novel, they're talking about the one thing God told them not to do, which was to eat the fruit of this particular tree. So Satan right away knows that's how you get them. I'm going to tempt Eve into eating the apple. And then what happens, he gets spied, that's book 4, he gets seen by some angels who are guarding Eden, and he has to leave. So he goes circling the earth like 7 times, and while he's up there circling the earth and figuring out a plan, in book 5, 6, 7, and 8, we hear Adam and Eve talking to a couple of angels about the war in heaven, about the creation of the earth, and other things like that. And this bores the heck out of everybody. As a story, but it's beautifully done and unbelievable poetry. All right, and it's just—it's beyond this course. But you know, I'm just telling you, it exists there. But it's not the most dynamic story. Well, anyway, Satan is circling around, and he lands in book 9, and that's the other book I assigned, and we'll take a look at that. Well, let's take a look at some scenes, and then he tempts Eve, and succeeds. I just wanted to go over some lines in book 1. Look at page 2557. Here, now what you've got is just parts of book 1. Most of it is a long discussion between Satan and the other fallen angels who all have names. And everything's biblically sound, anthropologically correct, but we don't need to. All we see here is Satan talking to a guy named Beelzebub at 81. Line 81, you see that name, Beelzebub. That's another fallen angel. And they first get the glimmers of what they're going to do now that they've lost the war. Okay, and again, they have this heroic, you know, never say die attitude, and people often associate that with Milton himself. I mean, Milton was this little guy, and he rose up under Cromwell. He became the number 2 guy in England. He was Cromwell's Latin secretary, writing to all the heads of Europe, defending the Puritan Revolution, defending the chopping off the head of the king. This is like a big no-no, killing, you know, chopping off heads of kings. He didn't do this sort of thing. All right, and as I said, on a rainy day, Milton was in the front row for that. Okay, at the Tower of London. Wouldn't have missed it for the world. All right. So we tend to associate him with Satan, but that's just a complete mistake, because it's just over. Satan is the sort of absence of God, and that's certainly not Milton's position. And this whole debate takes place with Satan and Beelzebub face down on a fiery lake, prone, and they can't even extricate. So they're in a rather, if you picture it, they're in a rather subservient position. Anyway, the line I want is line 54. He has fallen for 9 days. It took 9 days to fall from heaven down to this hell place. Milton actually doesn't read out loud that well, like a lot of things that I've done in the course, so I never found an out loud reading that satisfactory, so I'm not going to do a lot of it with you, but it reads well as you read it, if you go slowly. Line 53, he lay vanquished, rolling in the fiery gulf. You see that line? Line 53, confounded though immortal, but his doom reserved him to more wrath. For now the thought both of lost happiness and lasting pain torments him. Okay. Now this is a lovely little thought of what it's like when you've really messed up big. Okay. And you get nostalgic for the good old days. And in this particular line, Milton is deliberately echoing Virgil's Aeneid. Okay, where Aeneid is in a storm in the beginning of Book One, remembering the happier times in Troy before Troy fell. So you can just put down, see page 936. We can just flip over to that. It's not an exact fit, but it's good enough for me here. And it reinforces the point I want to make, that Milton is combining a biblical story with a classical framework, just like Dante did. This is the Western tradition we talk about. How do you combine the Greek-Roman tradition and this Hebrew biblical tradition? And it goes right up through Moby Dick, right? And it's still in the back of a lot of works today. And Milton's pretty successful. Well, on page 936, we see line 276. This very famous line in the Latin. Aeneas turns to his men who have just had a really rough 10 years wandering around the Mediterranean, and this is before the Dido episode. But he says, "Now call back your courage. And have done with fear and sorrow. Someday, perhaps, remembering even this will be a pleasure. We are so miserable now, but someday we'll be happy looking at this." Right? Now this is actually contrasts with Satan. Satan is miserable forever, thinking of the good times, because he has no hope, paradoxically. Aeneas is miserable and never really figures out what's going on, but he is the living embodiment of hope, which even when he can't see what's out there, he perseveres. Okay, he plunges on. He just keeps banging away at the job, as miserable as it is, because he's got that stick-to-itiveness. So anyway, it's the emphasis on memory, I guess, is the connection here. And there's another line that's similar to that from Dante, maybe closer to Satan, which is on page 1481. Let's see if I can find it. And this is your old friend Francesca, who was killed with Paolo. For their illicit love. And she says at line 120, this is Inferno 5. Are you with me? "There is no greater pain than to remember in our present grief past happiness." But this sounds directly like Satan, doesn't it? And you wonder, is it a clue, you know, that Dante was... I mean, after all, he did put Francesca in hell. Okay, so he kind of disapproved. But she's not like fully satanic yet. But it's the same thought, looking back, that misery, that mental misery. Just to prove to you that Satan is a comeback guy, turn to page, the next page, 2558. And we see at line 105, What though the field be lost? All is not lost, the unconquerable will. And study of revenge, immortal hate. Ah, these are good things. Right? See, he's indomitable. And we like that in him. But that's because we're not thinking, right? Exactly what's going on. Right? Look over, then again over at the line 158. He's talking to Beelzebub, who kind of wants to give up. He says, you know, that was Beelzebub. It's pretty rough war we just went through. And this is kind of a hot burning lake here, but you know, it actually is a little better than what we were facing up there and, you know, on the battlefield. And Satan sort of rouses him to action. Fallen, but it's the morality that I want to get at here. Fallen cherub, to be weak is miserable, doing or suffering. And that's their condition. But of this be sure, to do aught good never will be our task, but ever to do ill our soul delight. Well, just in my simple little brain, this seems to me the opposite of your Gilgamesh scene. He has essentially faced death, okay? But being immortal, he can't die. And he develops a sense of morality. He certainly knows good and ill, having been through this big experience, except that being Satan, he comes down on the wrong side. Okay? He's like, well, I think I'll just do the bad things from now on, okay? Remember, he was the brightest angel before he fell, and here he's fully conscious of morality and just choosing the wrong path. Okay, just fully consciously saying, "Let's do the bad stuff," because God likes the good stuff, and anything He likes, I don't like. Okay, so he has to do the bad stuff. This raises all kinds of contradictions because he certainly expects his followers to do what he wants and follow him, right? So that he has a sort of built-in sense of goodness he doesn't quite recognize. That he, you know, he wants to be number one. He wants certain things. So anyway, that's the paradox. Okay, and that's about enough for book one. That'll keep you busy. Okay, don't want to drag this out. Anyway, let me just talk about it. Milton's epic combines biblical story, as I said, with the classical epic form. It starts in the middle of things, if you've heard of that. The battle's already happened. It will get told in book six, but it's already happened. So we are in the middle of things. It's a classical form. Paradise Lost is written in 12 books. And if you remember your Virgil's Aeneid was written in 12 books. So he's, you know, imitating this form. And it's an epic. And there are lots of definitions of epic, but one of them is it uses very heightened language. And that's certainly, the poetry he's writing is very heightened. It's full of puns, difficult syntax, very exact nuances, all this music, and the point is the verse is supposed to reflect the thought, right? I don't think this is as obvious in Shakespeare as it actually is in Virgil or in Milton as it is in Virgil or Shakespeare, but it's there, and I'm not doing examples of it this semester. Okay. What else do we need? Okay. So let's go to book 9. That was the other bit. So this is the actual fall. And he starts with a little prologue. Because this is the height of the whole story. I mean, this whole story. And he says, you know, I'm telling you a story about one little episode in Genesis. And you may not think that's worthy of an epic, but I'm telling you, it's more worthy of an epic than all the stuff other people write epics about. Like war. Right? So look at line 14. Sad task to write this. Yet argument not less, but more heroic than the wrath of stern Achilles. See, if those guys were thinkers, if they'd read everything like I have, okay, they'd know I'm number one, not Homer. So this is direct competition. You got to admit that Milton's got chutzpah, right? He's got pride, thinks a lot of himself, okay? Not less, but more heroic than the wrath of stern Achilles on his foe pursued, thrice fugitive about Troy war, or rage of Turnus for Lavinia disespoused, or Neptune's ire. That's the Aeneid and then the Odyssey. Let's jump down to 27. He asks for his muse to help him. This is for real. He would go to bed and he would the lines would come to him during the night, and the ancients would say the muse was visiting him. I think we could probably explain it through the dynamics of brain cell movement and rapid eye movements and stuff like that. But and he would wake up in the morning with the lines in his head. He obviously was slightly insomniac, okay, thinking about these things. And being blind, he would have somebody come to his house and he would dictate the lines and the person would write them down. Okay. And that's what he's talking about here. And he's line 28. Not sedulous by nature to indict war, to write about war. Hitherto, the only argument heroic deemed, and then he looks with scorn on all the earlier epics, chief mastery to dissect with long and tedious havoc fabled knights in battles feigned. The better fortitude, what they should have been writing about, of patience and heroic martyrdom unsung. In other words, they didn't sing about patience and heroic martyrdom. Which unfortunately is not quite true, because Aeneas is quite the patient guy and so is Odysseus, right? But he's got lots of other war stories in his mind. And then he said, he asked for help to finish writing the thing, and I love this line, I don't know why, line 44. And I'll start at 41. Me of these, nor skilled nor studious, higher argument remains, sufficient of itself to raise that name. In other words, I want to be a poet, that name. Unless, here are the reasons why I might not succeed in this task. First of all, he's got to write it, he's got to publish it, people have to read it. Okay. Unless an age too late, like nobody reads anymore, or I'm too old, or cold climate. Only a guy in England could write this, okay? Where it's really wet and rainy and cold, and there's no central heating, so you have to wear gloves to bed. It's just a miserable condition. And in one of his writings, he says, we do as well as we can for 48 degrees of north longitude, which is, the Montana-Canada line, 46-40 or fight. It's actually further north than that. Okay. Or cold climate, or years damp my intended wing depressed. And I see they put a note on the wing there. What do they say? Well, those are the wings of poetry. Okay, he's flying up there on the wings of poetry, and he will fly high unless old age or this lousy English climate represses him. Now, I'm not going to go over the arguments. What you have in Book 9 is Adam and Eve talking together at length, and Eve giving a long argument why she should... They only have, and all they do all day is garden. Okay? They tend the vines. And Eve says, she doesn't say it in so many words, but the meaning is clear. I'm getting tired of you hanging around me all the time, Adam. I want to garden on my own. And Adam says, I want the job. I want to move to Florida. I want my own career. And Adam says to her, look, we've been warned and it's a really bad idea. And Eve says, well, if you think you can keep me in prison all my life, okay, but I'll be really ratty about it. So he finally lets her go. And she's gardening alone, and Satan sees her, and that's his moment. Because he's got it in his head that he can't... He's got to convince her to break saying by God that they're not supposed to, break the prohibition against eating the fruit. And he figures Adam is too clever. He's got to go for Eve. Well, this raises the whole question of misogyny in Paradise Lost, right? And for your, one of your extra credits, and we'll talk about extra credit in a minute, remind me, okay? Book 4 is an extra credit thing, right? And you can find the descriptions of Adam and Eve in there. It's not on the syllabus, but and you'll notice that he is taller than she is, and she's shorter, and he tends to look to God, and she looks, in the famous phrase, at the God in him. And 30 years ago, a famous book called Mad Woman in the Attic attacked this bitterly in the height of the women's movement, that this was raw misogyny. Okay, this is it. You know, he looks at God and she looks at the God in him. And all I can say is, A, yes, that's exactly what it is. This is Milton. He was writing in the 17th century. He really did believe women were inferior. He had never met a woman that he could talk to. Didn't mean women were inferior, but he thought they were. So that's just, you know. But he thought about it quite a great deal, actually. Okay. And I was always looking for the perfect woman, but seemed to always come home with the wrong one. All right. And this comment was the most famous. Lots of women scholars were attacking this. And one of them is a woman named Susan Gubar, teaches down at Indiana University. And she wrote The Mad Woman in the Attic. And the problem is, you put it all in context, Adam does not come off so great in this story either. As a matter of fact, he's a complete loser compared to Eve. And you could go through a complicated analysis in your next Milton class, right? Because he really abdicates all his responsibility. Eve was never really told directly what to do. So she, you know, her disobedience is really not as bad as his. And I asked Susan Gubar about that when she came up to Purdue to give a talk. And she's really a wonderful woman. And she says, yeah, I think I'll have to rewrite the book. You know, I thought about it in the last 30 years. And so she's not quite ready to condemn the way Milton portrays Eve, but look at book 4 to see their description. It's quite beautiful, and the whole description of paradise is there. So now, but we're in book 9, and the part, again, I'm not going to walk you through those arguments, but you can read through them. Eventually Eve gets separated and Satan sees her alone, and he decides this is his chance. So he sort of merges himself. He sees a serpent crawling along the ground, and he merges himself into the serpent. Okay, he'd already been in the shape of a toad earlier in the poem, whispering to Eve at night and giving her weird dreams. And it was because of these weird dreams that she got kind of antsy and wanted to go off and garden on her own. So let's look at line 425. And here we see Satan spying Eve, and the description of her is incredible. So I thought I'd start with that. Beyond his hope, Eve separate he spies, veiled in a cloud of fragrance. That's because there's flowers all around her. Where she stood, half spied. There's always this quasi-eroticism. Remember, she's not wearing any clothes here, but you know, because it's Satan, you put a slight bit of voyeurism in it, you know, she's sort of half seen. So thick the roses bushing round about her glowed, oft stooping to support each flower of slender stalk, whose head, though gay, carnation, purple, azure, or speckled with gold, hung drooping, unsustained. Them she upstays. She lifts up the flowers. Gently, with myrtle band. Myrtle is a kind of ivy. sacred to Venus. Mindless the while, herself, though fairest unsupported flower, from her breast best prop so far, and storm so nigh. That's metaphoric language, people. That's a poet talking, right? Does the description of the drooping flowers, then flips you right in that she's the, who's in this radiance, she's the unsupported flower, and just as she props up flowers, she needs the support of her prop, who would be, who would, Adam. Okay, so she's unsupported. You can do the argument, it works both ways, all right? And storm so nigh, and who do you think that storm is? Satan, okay? Nice little metaphor, because it's like a rainy day, okay? And he draws near, and he gets into the serpent, and to attract her attention, he does this little serpent dance. And if you're a big Walt Disney fan, you know that. What's the movie? I can't remember. What? The Jungle Book. Yeah, with the Shere Khan. Isn't that the guy's name? The serpent and the voice is. Oh, Shere Khan. What? Who's the?
Ka.
Ka. And who does the voice? Is it Sterling Hayden? Yeah, it's a famous voice. I may be wrong on this, but it
the tiger's a famous voice.
They're all famous voices. I can't remember. But anyway, I never knew who the guy was, but I caught one of these movies on the Turner Classic Movie from 1950, and that was him. But I think he was also the cop who punches Michael Corleone in The Godfather. Uh-huh. Although I notice like a lot of people haven't seen The Godfather. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the great movie, but I'm just always shocked at the. It's a generational thing. Okay. Anyway, let's take a look at this description of the dancing serpent, so to speak. This is line 494. So spake the enemy of mankind, enclosed in serpent, inmate bad, and toward Eve addressed his way. Not with indented wave, prone on the ground as since. See, but before the serpent was punished, he had a different form of locomotion. But on his rear, circular base of rising folds that towered, fold above fold, a surging maze, his head. So he doesn't. He's not doing this, right? He's doing this, right? Okay, with the head, you know, get those eyes looking at you, right? His head crested aloft, and carbuncle his eyes. That's red, ruby red eyes. Carbuncles are rubies. It's the end of the class. I can say something. I mean, when I was a kid, you know. Read the comic books, and there was this ad, send in like $4 or something for the silver skull ring with ruby red eyes. I saved up for that thing, and I sent in. And then, you know, it was one of those incredible disappointments, because there was the ruby red eyes. It was like two dots of red paint. Where are my rubies? Anyway, here's Satan with burnished neck of verdant gold, erect amidst his circling spires that on the grass floated redundant. What a poet! All right. Anyway, that's enough. Enough of him. Well, he tempts her, and let's jump to line 780. Basically, he says, look, what's wrong with knowledge? Knowledge is good. You want to be like a god? You dreamed last night about flying. Flying is good. Let's go for it. And she says, how come you can talk? I thought you were a serpent. He said, hey, I ate that thing. Right? She says, you know, that Adam's really bugging me. Like, he didn't talk to me. I'm going to eat this apple. Milton is on shaky ground there, people. but we won't press it. Anyway, let's go to line 780. So saying, her rash hand in evil hour, forth reaching to the fruit, she plucked, it's pronounced et. It says E-A-T, but it's the English have a way of pronouncing this as et. Eat wouldn't work here. Earth felt the wound and nature from her seat. This affects the entire universe, this fall. Okay. This fall, Milton talks about it through the whole thing. What does it mean to eat this thing? Well, it certainly explains the existence of our lives and the evil in our lives. We're all after the fall. Okay, that's why we're not perfect. All that this happened and we're suffering for it. Why should we suffer for it? No one knows. The big mystery. Right? But that's what God wanted, according to this story. So you're suffering for it. It does have the slight advantage that it allows redemption. You can't have redemption if you're not fallen. And the redemption comes in the form of the crucifixion, if you've taken atonement theory of the crucifixion, which is exactly what Milton had. Therefore, thinkers sit back and say, well, if the most important thing, the Christian thinkers, if the most important thing in the world is the crucifixion, it was a good thing that they ate that apple. Because we wouldn't have needed that whole apparatus of Christ descending into the world. And that's called the fortunate fall theory of the fortunate fall theory. The fortunate fall. How lucky we were that Eve did this. See, I always think you can take these earlier works and you don't have to read them like a bunch of male chauvinist pigs. They so easily turn around pro women, okay? And now that if you go to church, so many more women are preaching. You get the other side of these things, all right? Anywho, it affects the whole world. Earth felt the wound, and nature from her seed, sighing through all her works, gave signs of woe that all was lost. Back to the thicket slunk the guilty serpent, and well might. For Eve, intent now, wholly on her taste, naught else regarded. And so she eats the apple. Now, after Adam eats it, the world keeps shifting. And in fact, the whole earth, according to Milton, shifts on its axis. And that's when the seasons come in. So Milton had a really connected view of the world we don't have to get into. But he's writing in an interesting period because Galileo had really proven that the earth goes around the sun instead of the sun around the earth. And that changed people's perceptions. The reason he was persecuted was because it changed the whole relationship of man to the universe. If you're on a stationary earth, and here's the paradox again, the individual is important because the whole universe is circling you. That's how Dante would have seen the world. Okay, but after Galileo, you're just a little planet riding around the sun, and the sun is the central thing, right? And so man is displaced. Right? So you could argue complicated because our imagination of human beings is displaced. You actually have to pump them up a lot more, and you get a lot more sense of individuality, right? So you can work these things two ways. And Milton brings both theories into the poem in passages that they did not put into the anthology. Well, so that's bad. Let's see Adam's reaction, and that's at line 890. And this, for those of you who want, this will not even be an extra credit. This image comes from a poet named Statius, who shows up in Dante's Purgatory and wrote the Phidias, which I translated into English, but you don't get in this course because it's too complicated. But so let's look at the image. I'll start at 887. Thus Eve with countenance blithe. What's your countenance? You know what a countenance is? It's your face, right? Her story told. Hey, this stuff tastes great. And that nice serpent showed it to me. That's the story. But in her cheek, distemper flushing glowed. On the other side, Adam, soon as he heard the fatal trespass done by Eve, amazed, astonished, stood at blank, while horror chill ran through his veins and all his joints relaxed. From his slack hand, the garland wreathed for Eve down dropped. So you get these mini falls going on. Everything's falling. Okay. And all the faded roses shed. The very roses lose their color because of the... this is about as poetic as you can get, right? I mean, maybe they looked faded, maybe they really faded. And all the faded roses shed. Speechless, he stood and pale, till thus at length, first to himself, the endless silence broke. And they have he berates her a bit, but eventually she convinces him to eat the thing. I suppose I should have, I didn't think I'd have time for more of this. But they both eat it, and they're both wildly happy. And they do, and they enter their fallen state, and they decide, the first thing they do is have sex. Okay. And now the whole question of sex in paradise is a theological issue well beyond this class. But what's important is after they do, they get in an argument. Now, they've had an intellectual argument before, but they really get bitter. It's like, you know, waking up with a hangover. Okay, and it's a wonderful description. So read it. I mean, it's just it's life itself. Okay, all right. The honeymoon is over. As it is flawless. Well, they bicker and everything else through book 10, and then they get reconciled to their condition. In books 11 and 12, one of the angels comes down and says, "Look, we're going to show you a vision of the future." And Adam stands up on a hill and he looks at the future of the world. And it's everybody's least favorite part of Paradise Lost, but it's actually pretty good, but it's we don't need it. And when that speech is over, that's the end, and they have to leave Paradise. Paradise is the name of the garden they're in, okay? Paradise is actually a Persian word for garden, okay? The para is equal to a peri, which means around. This is the Persian, this is the Greek form. So what word do we have that has peri that means around?
Perimeter.
Perimeter. Periscope. Okay, so we have the word. The paradise is the enclosed, giant enclosed garden. A garden is not the little thing in our backyards. It's like 10,000 acres inside a wall. Okay, where you can have the Persian king can... Shahryar can, you know, chase animals when he's not murdering wives. Okay. All right. So, but anyway, they have to leave it. And that's why, that's the title of the poem, Paradise Lost. This is how they lost the paradise. And the very ending is really incredible. As they leave, they leave holding hands. And it's just a little touch, but it's enough, okay? That they're in this together. And it's actually borrowing some lines from Shakespeare. It's of Richard II when a character is exiled. He says, you know, I have to go save back to England. All the world's my way. I can go anywhere except come back to England. So let's just look at the last lines. This is page 26, 29. Oh, no, it isn't. It's... 26:31. Okay. So, some natural tears they dropped, but wiped them soon. The world was all before them, where to choose their place of rest, and Providence their guide. They, hand in hand, with wandering steps and slow, through Eden took their solitary way. Boom. Yeah. So, that's the end of the poem. Nice little moment. This guy's got it, right? Okay. So that's the end of the course. Goodbye. No. Do you have any questions? There's something I should be talking about now. I will write the exam. I'll send you a note about it. I think that's the fairest thing. Okay. Read the stuff. Even though I think a lot of you guys are a lot smarter than I know. Not that you're not showing him. I meant more wonderful personalities than I allowed you to show in class. So I'm sorry I didn't have a little inter-class soccer game for you. I know there's always a soccer champion out there, somebody who plays the guitar and all that sort of jazz. So you strike me as very talented students, and I'm glad you took the course, and I hope you do really well on the exam. Some of you to show me again how great you are, and others to make up for, you know, past deficits. So I've enjoyed you very much, and I'll let you go.
What other extra credit was there besides?
Extra credit. Oh. All right, after all that speech. Well, what do you want for extra credit? Throw me some ideas here. I haven't been back in my head. I was going to...
Yeah.
What?
Bonus points just for showing up today.
You want credit for showing up today?
Yeah.
All right. You got a piece of paper there?
Yeah, I do.
All right. Send that around. So you don't want any extra credit or anything? I was going to try and keep the exam to an hour. You get 2 hours here. And then have an hour for extra credit. But maybe you just want the exam. You want a little attendance. Actually, you've been really good about the attendance. I was shocked. I mean, you guys showed up as much as you did. I taped the thing, and I was really, really pleased. Because usually means it's like, I'm not that boring. Okay, you're showing up for class. So I'll give you some extra credit for your attendance. If everybody, don't all mess up together, but actually it's better if you do all mess up together. But that's beyond your capability of planning it out. But no, you favorably impressed me, and all the pluses are on your side, because there was not an attendance requirement, and most of you religiously showed up, or let me know why anyway. So. Any other thing I can talk about? Did you have some lines you were going
to
recite?
Yeah, but I didn't get a chance to memorize them, so I'm the only one that they have.
Did anybody else have something they wanted to do? Some last? Do you want me to read my paper? You don't want to hear that.
Yeah.
This is wretched stuff. But all right, this is a way to study. You know what goes through my head. You ready? You're not going to like this. I'll read while that's going around. Connecting mortality to morality in the world literature classroom. So I thought I'd write a little essay here. If there is an ultimate source of morality, it is difficult to prove logically. And if there is not, there ought to be, since otherwise there is no other rule than might is right. We might follow Plato's demonstration of the contradiction of this rule, since even an evil man has expectations about what is due to him, thereby creating a system of right and wrong. It is not clear, however, that strong evil men think this way or think at all as they impose their desires on others. They do listen to stories, however, or at least that is what much early literature seems to presume. If there is any point to a plot line that occurs in various works of fiction from various countries and various time periods. In the ancient Babylonian epic of Gilgamesh, for example, the hero is a brutal man who robs and rapes and generally creates havoc until the death of his friend makes him suddenly realize his own mortality, whereupon he reforms his ways, as if realizing that somehow there is a higher standard for behavior than his own inclinations. This sort of thing happens in many stories, providing a connecting theme that justifies the study of world literature and the inclusion of texts like the Bible that are sacred to some and works that are not strictly speaking fiction. The very mix one finds in a sophomore level course based on something like the Norton Anthology of Western Literature. The pattern in which a hero recognizes his mortality and develops a new sense of morality provides a way of comparing works from Western as well as the wider realms of world literature that are often difficult to fit into a single course. The pattern is often accompanied by riddles, probably because death and suffering are riddles themselves. These riddles range from simple metaphors to the parables of Jesus. Sometimes metamorphosis replaces death as the catalyst for conversion. Scheherazade, whose custom in telling 1,001 stories is to convince King Shahryar to end his custom of marrying women at night and killing them in the morning, starts by telling stories of people turned into animals by magic. And I didn't assign those, but you might want to read those someday. They just don't strike me as that great, but I can see intellectually where they're coming from. The implication is that there is therefore a proper standard to follow, even for a king. Sometimes it is the reader rather than the protagonist whose point of view changes. Ovid's metamorphosis features both unruly gods and a developing sense of Roman civility. Beowulf never confronts death emotionally, and therefore it is hard to find a full sense of morality beyond the warrior virtues of courage and gift-giving. But the Christian poet who narrates the story expects his readers to respond to the images of mortality, such as the opening burial at sea of Scyld's sheaf son, and realize that the distance between proper morality and the behavior of Beowulf, that there is a distance, and that Beowulf's values are muddled in the end. Sometimes the author uses death to open the eyes of his audience to changes he proposes. Thucydides' Peloponnesian War starts with an account of a plague, but the moral seems to be the decline of political justice. Boccaccio's Decameron begins with the story of the plague of 1348 in order to justify a new morality of sexual freedom for women. Some works invert the pattern of the moral discovery. Satan fails to realize how close he came to dying when God defeats him before the opening of Milton's Paradise Lost, and therefore, instead of learning good, he vows that to do aught good never will be our task, but ever to do ill our sole delight. Learning the wrong message is possible. Here's where I start drifting. The idea that death can open someone's eyes to the good is perhaps not very profound. Nabokov, a modern novelist, satirizes it when he attributes the weird behavior of one of his characters to an eschatological shock. A popular song, not by Suzanne Vegas, it turns out, but by Jenny Lewis. You ever heard of her? A song called Science Versus Romance? No? I mean, this is, I've never heard of it, but my son had it on his iPod. Anyway, this song includes the line, "I used to think if I could realize I could die, then I would be a whole lot nicer." Isn't that great? Is that captured or not?
Yeah.
All right. But an idea may be no less important merely because of its simplicity. Whether the idea is true or not is not important in a story, since the point is that it operates as a structuring principle, not an item of faith. It is what C.S. Lewis would call a myth, that is, a mythos or plot. Mythos is Greek for plot. Now, it happens that Lewis believed that one could logically infer the existence of God from our innate sense of right and wrong. This proof of God is the theme of all his religious writing. What I find remarkable is that, although in life he seems to have believed in every little detail of Christian faith, at least according to an account of him by a guy named A.L. Rouse, his writings almost never stray beyond this fundamental postulate of faith, which can be summarized by observing that as soon as we say something ought to be, we are presuming a standard of morality, and the existence of that standard is enough to justify a belief in God or whatever it is that has created the standard. And I'm getting complicated here. The plot line I find in many stories usually lacks Lewis's logical leap to the existence of God, but it implies it. According to a guy named Kenneth Burke, when the first two terms of a dialectic are stated, the third can be implied, particularly in poetry, where thought can be suggested rather than expressed. Given the first two terms, mortality and morality, the third, by Burke's logic, is that God exists. In a story, the third term does not need to be spelled out. Indeed, none of these stories complete the dialectic, but by the same token, they support a belief system when one is demanded. This suggestion of belief works especially if by God we mean a proposition that something, we cannot know what, has determined in morality that whatever we think is felt as a result of the confrontations with death that shape the kind of stories that endure through the ages and wind up in college anthologies. Editors like stories that can be interpreted in various ways. What is important is not the nature of morality, since actual practices are often determined as much by custom as by sheer right and wrong. What matters is that there is a right and wrong, a call for morality that appeals to both conservatives and those who call for change. Gilgamesh is a story that raises moral issues without legislating proper behavior beyond a minimum, while at the same time creating a mysterious sense of a higher power. This mysteriousness, like the problem of mortality, makes the inclusion of riddles appropriate to the fiction, something we also see in works like Oedipus Rex, where Oedipus misunderstands the Delphic Oracle, or the story of Genesis, where the interpretation of dreams plays a key role. And then I just could walk through all the stories. Okay, but that is enough to sit there and try and write it to make me appreciate your tough task. Okay, so anything else?
I have a question.
Yeah.
In that, you said, according to a guy named...
Kenneth Burke.
Okay.
Essay on Coleridge.
And okay to think that, according to a guy named...
Did I say a guy named?
Yes.
Well, this is unrevised, don't forget. No, it's not written that way. I added that just for you.
What was the thesis statement?
That's a really good question. I was... And I had to really work on it for that. I just wanted to call it mortality and morality, but I said, well, I got to have an idea. So, really, I pulled a fast one, and I showed it's the idea of connecting works for a college course. Okay, this pattern in which, and then I subordinate that key idea, this pattern in which a hero recognizes his mortality and develops a new sense of morality. That's just the subject. That's not the key verb yet.
Right.
Provides a way of comparing works from Western as well as wider realms of literature. And then I can show, and as I go through this, I'll show this is on and off thing in Western literature, and it's interesting to look at the Chinese poems too, and that I could develop it that way. So the thesis was, this idea provides a connecting link through the stories in this course.
I was waiting for the all those statements. So I was just...
Yeah, I didn't. But you're absolutely right. But it's in there, and I could finish it up being, although it doesn't always work. Okay. All right. But yeah, good question. All right. So you learned something. Ah. All right.
I'm going to schedule the final.
Yes. There's one other person, I think, for Wednesday at noon, right?
I don't know if it's love or new. I don't know what you said.
Did you write it down? I have it on my...
Yeah, I've been... Is it possible you can email me that time again?
So. Email me. I will email you back.
Okay. And can I bring Friday Dan papers?
Yep.
On that day?
Yep.
Okay.
The emails? Oh, I sent you... I had your... Did you want that first? Oh, this is your project. Yeah, there you are. Okay. Yo, all right, so you're all embarrassed to talk? You want to? Oh, do you want to go upstairs then?